Welcome back to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn, and I'm here with Cokie Roberts, political commentator at NPR and author of Capital Dames, The Civil War and the Women of Washington from 1848 to 1868. Cokie, the women that you write about in this book are generally smart and driven and ambitious and passionate, and yet some of these women maintain friendships across the lines of the Civil War. How is that possible? How were Verena Davis and Elizabeth Blair Lee, for example, able to do that?
Well, not only ambitious and smart and all of that, but passionate about their views. So the friendships were somewhat remarkable. Elizabeth Blair Lee was the daughter of Francis Preston Blair, who, of course, was one of Lincoln's advisors, and her brother Montgomery Blair was in the cabinet, and her brother Frank Blair was in the Congress, and her husband, Samuel Phillips Lee, who was a cousin of Robert E. Lee, was in the Union Navy. And as a result of that, we have her letters. She wrote to him almost every day. And her wartime letters have actually been published. God love them. So that is, you know, she was a very wonderful resource. She was quite friendly with Verena Davis, whose husband had been in Washington as a Secretary of War in the Senate. And then, of course, he became the president of the Confederacy. And when the mail was cut off between Virginia and the Union, it became very difficult for people to know what was going on with their friends. And so Lizzie Lee was always grateful when she got news of Verena Davis. And so she wrote to her husband, she said, "I can't for an instant divest myself of the feeling that they are my people, my countrymen, madmen as they are. My heart aches for them." She's talking about, of course, the Confederates. Now, she didn't feel that way about my hometown of New Orleans. She said, "There they are my enemies, and I feel it, but always think of them as Frenchmen and quadroons." But the people of Virginia and Kentucky and Missouri were Lizzie's friends and relatives, and she was particularly happy when she did get news of Verena Davis. And I'm quoting again. She said, "Memory overlapped the horrid gulf now between us and took her back to the happiest part of her life, that spent in Washington. The First Lady of the Confederacy had relayed a message that Lizzie Lee would be to me dear unto life's end. The captain of a French steamer docked in Washington reported from his trip to Richmond, astonished there was so much at the warmth of friendship expressed by individuals separated by this war. But still, they killed each other." I mean, 600,000 Americans dead at the end of the Civil War, more than that. Still the tragedy of all time. And, of course, Rachel, it's a tragedy of politics and of statesmanship. These men should have been able to figure this out without killing hundreds of thousands of Americans. And the women actually came to understand that and to write about that. One woman, a Confederate woman, whose last name I never discovered, but she was writing to her friend Agnes Pryor, and Sarah Agnes Pryor. And Sarah Pryor was the wife of a real hothead Confederate, Roger Pryor. And he was in Congress and then in the Confederate Army. And Agnes wrote to Sarah, as the war was winding down, and she was in Richmond seeing the starvation there. And she said, "You know, when we went to those debates in the House and the Senate and watched people arguing about the expansion of slavery into the territories, we had no idea that this is what would happen as a result of it." And she said, "And someone is to blame for it, and it's not you, and it's not I."
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking with Cokie Roberts, political commentator at NPR and at ABC News. She's also the author of a new book, Capital Dames. And in the book, Cokie, you write about Jessie Benton Fremont and her visit to President Lincoln to lobby on behalf of her husband.
Well, that's another thing, Rachel. These women were going in the White House all the time, no matter who was president. They would just march on into the White House and beat up the man who was the president. And I have to tell you, I'm wildly jealous ridiculous. I mean, it is.
They would actually get an audience.
Oh,
with
totally.
Him.
And the president would be intimidated by them. And it was fabulous to behold. And they'd write these letters, you know, talking about how they went to see the president, and they told the president this, and they told the president that. And in Jesse Fremont's case, she said, you know, a man goes in and he's said that he's sticking to his principles. A woman does, and she's just considered a bad-tempered woman.
Yes. So has that changed
no,
in the last 150 years? It hasn't.
When you write history and read history, what you understand is very little changes. And that's one of the great values of reading history, is to understand that things have been like this and that they are likely to continue on like this unless you do something about it. And so it is very, very useful.
You also write about White House fever or presidentitis taking hold.
You know, Morris Udall, who was a longtime member of the House from Arizona, who ran for president at one point, had the wonderful joke that the only cure for presidentitis is embalming fluid. And the and President Lincoln, talking about his cabinet member, Salmon Chase, who was his Treasury Secretary, said, you know, the man has just got the White House fever and there's no way around it. And he understood it even when he appointed Chase as Chief Justice, that it was very likely that even from the court that Chase was likely to run for president again. Now, part of the reason for that was his daughter, Kate Chase Sprague, who was a politician beyond belief and written about Rachel as a politician. I mean, that's one of the great advantages to writing about this period of history, the Civil War period, is that the newspapers are all available. This is the great joy of the modern age. Newspapers are now all online, and so you can read in real time what they were reading and writing and saying about the women. And remarkably, the women were written about in the newspapers. And Kate Chase was described as a politician who ran her father's campaigns, and particularly in 1868, she was the person who ran his campaign at the convention in New York. And that was all documented in the papers. So you have these stories that really you think this is something new under the sun with women being in these political positions, and it's just not true at all.
You also write about Dorothea Dix, and our listeners may recognize that name because for years the hospital in her honor in Raleigh, North Carolina, was the subject of a lot of debate. It finally closed, and the city of Raleigh...
It's actually wonderful what's happening. The city of Raleigh is taking it as a park and a wonderful downtown space, but also proceeds will go to the help of the mentally ill. And Dorothea Dix was, of course, so involved. It's unbelievable what she did. By the time she died, she had established more than 100 hospitals for the mentally ill, including two in Japan, which means this woman traveled by herself in the mid-19th century to Japan and was able to open hospitals. She was so influential before the war even that she came to Washington to lobby, and she was given by the Senate an office in the Capitol from which to lobby because she was so highly acclaimed. And she established in Washington, she established the Government Hospital for the Insane, which is still there, St. Elizabeth's, which is where John Hinckley is at the moment. But she, during the war, of course, took on a different role, came to Washington, went to the Surgeon General and said, I will be the superintendent of nurses. Now, there were no nurses. There were no female nurses except for Catholic nuns. And she was she established a nursing corps. And that had the effect of opening that whole profession to women, which was not true before the war. People don't think about that. But there were about three women doctors in the country at the time, and one of them, Mary Walker, was a surgeon. She came to Washington to work for the Union Army. They wouldn't hire her because she was a woman. She also dressed like a man, so she would get arrested periodically. But she finally, she volunteered with the Army and then finally was hired and sent into very dangerous circumstances and had a horrific experiences during the war. And she is still today, Rachel, the only woman to have received the Medal of Honor.
Wow.
Dr. Mary Walker.
Wow. I was talking with someone about this era who said, well, you know, certainly women would have had an influence on public policy and on policymakers, but they didn't play direct roles in the war. And that just is patently untrue.
That's right.
There were even women who were acting as soldiers.
Oh, sure. That's been true in all of our wars, starting with the Revolution, but or maybe the French and Indian War, I don't know. But I certainly know about the Revolution. In fact, one time after we had had a conversation on a Sunday show about women in the military, some man sent me a facsimile copy of the discharge papers of one Frank Deming from the Union Army, in fact, it was. And it went through Frank's service, and he had done a yeoman job. And then it says, reason for discharge is because he is female. and then it said it was a congenital condition.
I'm assuming there are boxes to check. It's congenital or it's...
So, but there, the estimate is that there were somewhere around 400 women who, in both the Confederate Army and the Union Army, 400 total, who dressed as men and went out and fought. And, in fact, one of the women who was, of course, very active in the war was Clara Barton. And one of the soldiers she treated turned out to be a woman disguised as a man. But Clara Barton's story is really phenomenal, and she's one of the people that you think you know about.
Right. Because the founder of the Red Cross,
right, which is, of course, by the by, that is nothing that makes me crazier, right? She founded the American Red Cross. Oh, really? Was it hard? Did she have to do anything before that? You know, but she was in Washington working for the government. Again, women were working for the government. And she, when the war started and soldiers from her home state of Massachusetts arrived, she started supplying them and nursing them. And she was so good at it, they wrote home and said, send the stuff to her. And by the time she had three warehouses full of supplies, the quartermaster's office sent her with her supplies to the front. And she then was at the front for several battles, including Antietam, doing really terrifying work with bullets around her and going through her dress and all of that. And then after the war, one of Lincoln's last acts was to allow her to establish a Bureau of Missing Persons. And so she found soldiers and connected them with families, but she also marked tens of thousands of graves so that those soldiers had the dignity and respect of being known, not unknown. And that was all before she started the American Red Cross.
There was another woman who acted as a spy who actually had an impact on the outcome of some battles, Rose Greenhow.
And she's buried right here in Wilmington. Well, she was quite a woman. She was a Washington hostess of some renown, and she entertained politicians of all parties and all regions. She entertained some of them late at night with the shades drawn. And she was a Confederate sympathizer. And as the war was about to begin, one of the Confederate officers came to her and asked her to establish a spy ring, which she was happy to do. And so she enlisted some other Confederates in her cause, and she was able to get the details of the plans for the Battle of Bull Run, Manassas, and got them through one of her spies, a beautiful young woman who, and I always love these stories, you know, she went across the bridges were very heavily guarded into Virginia for obvious reasons. And she went across the bridge disguised as a farmer girl and then got to a friendly house, changed into riding gear and took off and met with the Confederate officers in Fairfax. And these are the kinds of stories you love. She let down her beautiful, long, luxuriant hair, and underneath it, pinned underneath her hair were the plans for the Battle of Bull Run, Manassas. And so much to the amazement of the Union, the South won the war, the battle. And it was a huge event because they really thought at that point that they would just polish off the South. It would be done and be over. And, of course, it was 4 long years.
Now, is that a little bit of a Freudian slip there? It's interesting that you write about this period, considering your personal history.
Right.
All of my ancestors. Your great-grandfather, your father's great-uncle.
Right.
Which side of the Civil War were they on?
Oh, they were Confederates, absolutely. I'm from Louisiana.
And does that influence the way you see the war at all? Are there any sort of visceral feelings of...
Well, I certainly grew up, as all people in the South of a certain age and class, frankly, grew up on hearing the horrors of the North and where the Southerners hid the silver. There was always where they hid. I mean, you'd think the Yankees would have caught on at some point because they all seemed to hide the silver in the fan windows over the front door. But at any rate, but so I certainly grew up with all of that. But certainly do believe that, again, what we're talking about is a failure of politics, a failure of statesmanship. I think that you cannot argue that the decision to secede was wise. It was crazy. And the effect of that was to devastate the South for generations to come. You know, it was this prosperous, thriving part of the country, and that all disappeared with the war. And you know, you can say, well, it couldn't have kept up without a slave economy. There's no evidence to support that. And you know, there are places that couldn't. The rice plantations couldn't. But it was a profound failure on the part of politicians.
We have about a minute before we go to break, but are there lessons? You talk about a failure of statesmanship. Are there lessons
sure,
that modern-day leaders
are.
need to take in?
Of course. I mean, what the country was founded on, as Bill Clinton says, the Constitution is let's make a deal. The country was founded on compromise. That's the way you legislate. You have to compromise to legislate. That's the only way you can legislate. And the notion that you stand in your corner and yell at each other is not any way to get anything done.
And how do we bridge some of those gaps? Because that seems
leadership.
To be what's...
The answer is leadership and voters getting mad and saying we want to see that leadership. The voters, in the end, bridge the gap.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. Cokie Roberts is here today, NPR political commentator. She's talking about her book, Capital Dames. And when we come back, we'll hear about her life as a political commentator at NPR and ABC News. We'll take a short break and be right back. This is Coastline.